You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Hello, and welcome to The Real Short Box. You know what you're here for? You're here for part two of Marvel's Silver Age, but part 3B of the whole Marvel history, because the Silver Age, we really, really wanted to get it all in one, but it's goddamn impossible, and we're still not going to get it, but we will try and finish it out as much as we can in this pod. We're still going to be talking about some of the characters that changed the Marvel Universe, created the Marvel Universe in this pod. Who do we got now? Who do we want to shoot with?
We're going to move on to a very angry character. Ooh. Debuted in 1962, the Incredible Hulk. Dr. Bruce Banner, please break it down, Donald.
All right. So, during the experimental detonation of a gamma bomb, scientist Bruce Banner saves teenager. Which teenager?
Rick Jones.
Rick Jones.
Strumming his guitar like a jackass.
Yep. He was driven onto the testing field. What a moron. Banner pushes Jones into a trench to save him, but is hit with a blast, absorbing massive amounts of gamma radiation. He awakens later, seemingly unscathed. But that night transforms into a lumbering gray form, because he was originally gray.
That's right.
A pursuing soldier dubs the creature a Hulk. Originally, Banner transformed into the Hulk at sunset and reverted at sunrise.
He was like a werewolf?
Yeah. Banner was cured in the Incredible Hulk number 4. Yeah.
That's it. Book's done.
But chose to restore Hulk's powers with Banner's intelligence. The gamma ray machine needed to affect the transformation induced side effects that made Banner temporarily sick and weak when returned to his normal state. Now, something that not everybody knows, but the Hulk was canceled.
Really?
Pretty
early.
Early on into its career. I believe it was issue 6, if I recall, was the last issue of The Incredible Hulk.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they canceled it. He was a founding member of the superhero team, the Avengers. By the Avengers number 3, overuse of the gamma ray machine rendered the Hulk as an uncontrollable, rampaging monster subject to spontaneous changing. In Tales to Astonish number 59, the Hulk appeared to be antagonist. He was an antagonist for Giant Man, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The series established stress as the trigger for Banner turning into the Hulk and vice versa. It was during this time that the Hulk developed a more savage and childlike personality, shifting away from his original portrayal as a brutish but not entirely unintelligent figure, which is where you get that very special, very seminal Fantastic Four issue, I believe, where the Hulk was hiding to the side, mm-hmm. and there's that thought bubble that he has.
Right.
And I'm, you know, when I'm like a teenager and I'm looking at that, I'm like, how the hell is he thinking? Like, you know, the Hulk's like smash, smash, smash.
Right.
Hey, that's what should be in a thought bubble, but it's like a whole phrase that he's thinking. It's very seems very intelligent. So I was a little confused by
he's
that.
He's having a Wonder Years moment. He's like, at that moment, I knew that I might have been in love with Alicia.
Right. Or could be more Unrested Development than Wonder Years. But you know, tomatoes, tomatoes. In Tales to Astonish number 77, Banner's and the Hulk dual identity became publicly known when Glenn Talbot, Banner's romantic rival for
Betty Ross,
witnessed his transformation, turning Banner into a wanted fugitive. So then that's when the whole thing came where he was wanted by the government,
mm-hmm.
and Banner was being hunted, and the Hulk was being hunted.
Always on the run. Yeah.
Right. The Hulk first appeared in The Incredible Hulk number 1, written by, at the time, it was Stan Lee, and co-plotted by Jack Kirby. It was patiently apparent that the monstrous character, the Hulk, was the most popular character in Marvel's recently created superhero team, the Avengers. For a long time, I'd been aware of the fact that people were more likely to favor someone who was less than perfect. But how can you name any of the heroic, handsome, or more glamorous characters? And then there's Frankenstein. He's always had a soft spot in his heart for Frankenstein's monster. Not one could ever convince me that he was the bad guy. And this is Stan talking, by the way.
Right.
He never wanted to hurt anyone. He merely groped his torturous ways through a second life, trying to defend himself, trying to come to terms with those who sought to destroy him. I decided I might as well borrow from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as well, Our protagonist would constantly change from his normal identity to a superhuman alter ego and back again.
It's completely Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, so you've got a Frankenstein monster being persecuted and hunted, mm-hmm. and Dr. Jekyll and Hyde, a normal scientist genius and a crazy monster.
Brute.
Yeah. You know, at a certain time when stressed or when not taking whatever, I think Jekyll and Hyde would take a formula or something, if I recall. Yeah. The color in the debut, Lee chose gray for the Hulk because he wanted a color that did not suggest any particular ethnic group. However, he had problems with gray coloring, resulting in different shades of gray and even green in the issue. After seeing the first issue published, Lee chose to change the skin color to green. Green was used in retellings of the origin, with even reprints of the original story being recolored for the next two decades.
Oh, wow.
Until The Incredible Hulk Volume 2, Number 302... which reintroduced the Gray Hulk in flashbacks set to close to the original story. Since then, reprints of the first issue have displayed the original gray coloring, with a fictional canon specifying that the Hulk's skin had initially been gray.
Right.
So I'm wondering if those issues, like the reprints that they did of him where he was green,
mm-hmm.
if those are of any value or more value than the reprints that show him as the original.
They got to be up there. I would definitely think, like, yeah, like real collectors are going to specify, like, whoa, 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 this is the reprint, he's green. You know, but I'm sure even those are still money. You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So further publication, the Hulk's original series was canceled with issue 6.
Wow.
Lee wrote each story with Kirby penciling the first 5. The character immediately guest starred in Fantastic Four. And months later became a founding member of the Avengers, appearing in the first 2 issues of the team's series and returning as an antagonist in issue 3 and as an ally in issue number 5. So he's all over the board. He then guest starred in Fantastic Four, number 25 through 26, which revealed Banner's full name as Robert Bruce Banner.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Now, why do you have like a slightly different name on the TV show? Like that TV show with
Bill I never Bixby. Understood that. Yeah, it was David Banner.
David Banner.
Yeah,
that yeah. I know. Never understood. There's some reasoning, but it's...
Yeah, that I don't know. The interesting thing about this is that around the time that co-creator Kirby, around the time of the cancellation of the Hulk, he received a letter from a college dormitory stating the Hulk had been chosen as its official mascot. Kirby and Lee realized the character had found an audience in college-age readers.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, they canceled it after 6.
Yeah.
A year and a half after The Incredible Hulk was canceled, the Hulk became one of 2 features in Tales to Astonish, beginning in issue number 60. This new Hulk feature was initially scripted by Lee with pencils by Steve Ditko, again, Steve Ditko, and inks by George Russo's. And I'm sorry if I butchered that. Other artists later in this run included Jack Kirby, Gil Kane, John Buscema. All kinds of really heavy hitters would take place in this. So the Hulk was hugely popular then. Popular enough that eventually he got his own television series.
Right. I did, as we're doing this with the miracle of this Google thing.
Yeah. Yes.
I found out why they changed the name of Bruce Banner to, I guess they called him, he was actually David Bruce Banner. Or Dave, but they mostly just called him David Banner on the TV show with Bill Bixby. There's a bunch of reasons. Johnson changed the name of the Hulk's comic book alter ego. So I guess he was the show creator. Dr. Bruce Banner to Dr. David Banner for the TV series. This change was made according to Johnson because he did not want the series to be perceived as a comic book series. So he wanted to change what he felt was a staple of comic books, as Stan Lee comics in particular, that major characters frequently had alliterative names, Peter Parker, Bruce Banner.
Oh, I thought it was kind of silly then.
Right, exactly. So, but according to both Stan Lee and Lou Ferrigno, it was also changed because CBS thought the name, this is so bad, CBS thought the name Bruce sounded, quote, too gayish.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. A rationale that Ferrigno thought was the most absurd, ridiculous thing I'd ever heard.
Lou Ferrigno, he's kind of a dick.
But I've heard things, well, but either way.
Don't take his picture at the Comic Con.
but then
sorry,
again,
Lou. That's just what I've heard.
Sorry, Lou. But then again, on the DVD commentary of the pilot, Johnson says that it was a way to honor his son, David. Mm. Bruce.
Aw, that's sweet.
Bruce ultimately became the TV Banner's middle name, as it had been in the comics. It is visible on Banner's tombstone at the end of the pilot movie, and that footage is shown at the beginning of every episode of the series. So it was either too gayish or he didn't like alliterations. You be the judge.
I thought it might have been, like, for some reason, because Lou couldn't say Bruce. And then I thought, well, he's not playing Bruce. Because he had, you know, at that time, his accent or like, it was really hard for him to enunciate some things very clearly. And I think it was because of his hearing or something.
He's mostly deaf, I believe.
Yeah. So it made it a little hard for him. So I was thinking in my head, I'm like, oh, that could be. And then I was like, no, wait, he didn't play.
Right,
he didn't David talk. Or Bruce. He was just like, so that was out the window.
But that's what made me not like the show as a kid, because it wasn't comic booky. It was just kind of like put me to sleep.
I didn't like it either, to be honest. I did not like it. There wasn't early in the 70s, there wasn't many TV shows I could, like, superhero wise or anything like that I could really get behind. It wasn't until the 80s. Right. When I started to get behind some of the TV series that would come out.
You like Linda Carter and Wonder Woman?
No, that didn't even catch on with me either. I guess the closest thing would have been Batman from the
60s. Yeah.
From the 60s.
Wait, you like Spider-Man with the scotch tape webbing?
No.
No, it wasn't even like scotch. It was like if you took a cotton ball and kind of like spread it out.
Yeah, it was really bad. It was really bad. Yeah, Greatest American Hero, I thought, did pretty well.
I did watch that, but that was all in humor and stuff like that. Yeah,
so that's why I enjoyed that, too. It was humor-esque.
Right.
I think that's going to do me for the Hulk here, or I'm done doing the Hulk.
Well, it's funny, I see on your piece of paper there, it'd be appropriate if you needed to talk about Thor, because Thor was one of the next heroes that came out in 1962.
Well, I guess I will continue on
then.
Journey into Mystery / The Mighty Thor. Further... A little bit more on Marvel's history with heroes. They did the Avengers, and part of the Avengers was Thor. He was in the Avengers.
Right.
And he was one of the early charter members.
Yes, he was.
And it's very important to discuss him. It's very important to discuss a lot of these guys, and some of these guys we're not going to be able to talk or point at too hard, and one of them being Iron Man. And I'm sorry, Tony. I'm sorry, Robert Downey Jr. as well.
But to be honest, you're doing fine.
Yeah, okay? you're doing fine, and everybody knows a lot about you. People at this
point, they know about you.
Yeah. The Marvel Comics superhero Thor debuted in a science fiction fantasy anthology title, Journey into Mystery, number 83.
Which was from Atlas Comics.
Right, I have it in my bathroom. It's rolled up. I occasionally read it when I'm taking a crap.
You hit roaches with it?
Yeah. Yeah. Came out in 1962, 63, somewhere around there. It was created by editor-plotter, of course, Stan Lee, scripter Larry Lieber, and penciler, plotter Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
So a different version of the mythological Thor had appeared previously in Venus, number 12 through 13.
Oh, wow.
And this was one of the ones we talked about when we talked about, I think it was, Timely?
Right.
Venus was part of that world, initially.
I want to see some weird, like, crazy, like, mythology historian who's like, that Journey into Mystery is not the first Thor. It's actually these tomes from Denmark. You know, like, you fucking asshole. Yeah. Loki actually appeared in...
Loki just actually appeared. Yeah. So Lee, in 2002, he described Thor's genesis early in the Marvel pantheon following the creation of the Hulk. Here's what he had to say. How do you make someone stronger than the strongest person? It finally came to me. Don't make him human. Make him a god.
Yes.
I decided readers were naturally and already pretty familiar with the Greek and Roman gods.
Mm-hmm.
It might be fun to delve into the old Norse legends. Besides, I pictured Norse gods looking like Vikings of old with the flowing beards, horned helmets, and battle clubs. Journey into Mystery needed a shot in the arm, so I picked Thor to headline the book. After writing an outline depicting the story and the characters I had in mind, I asked my brother, Larry, to write the script because I didn't have time.
Larry, I'm going to a party. Can you write this Thor script?
Larry Lieber, yes.
And it was only natural for me to assign the penciling to Jack the Man Kirby. In a 1984 interview, Kirby said, I did a version of Thor for DC in the 50s before I did him for Marvel. I created Thor at Marvel because I was forever enamored of legends, which is why I knew about Baldur, Heimdall, and Odin. I tried to update Thor and put him into a superhero costume, but he was still Thor. And in a 1992 interview, Kirby said, I knew the Thor legend very well, but I wanted to modernize them. I felt that might be a new thing for comics, taking the old legends and modernizing them. Thor's father, and this is no longer Kirby speaking, but Thor's father, Odin, decides, and this is just a little story, little backdrop into Thor.
Real quick before you go into the story, I was waiting for you to be like, and then I saw Stan Lee sitting in a corner crying, and I was like, hey, cheer up, buddy, I'll figure out this Thor situation for you. Yeah. And then Stan's like, what the fuck? I wasn't crying?
Wow.
So here's a little bit of the biography of the character. Thor's father, Odin, decides his son needed to be taught humility and consequentially places Thor, without memories of godhood, into the body and memories of an existing, partially disabled human medical student, Donald Blake.
That's right.
Now, this one, I never understood.
It was a weird one.
It was weird as shit, and he had that, like, cane thing.
Like an old wooden cane. Yeah. Like, it's not like they didn't have, like, regular canes in the 60s. He's like, I'll still carry this old wooden stick.
Yeah. So he would just smash it, and then he would turn into Thor.
I wonder if they got that whole transformation thing from Captain
Marvel.
That's
what I'm thinking.
Because that's, you know, in the lightning and all that stuff.
Because at that time, Because
there also was Freddie Freeman, who was Captain Marvel Jr., who was disabled, and he would say Shazam and become Captain Marvel Jr.
Well, hey, Martin Goodman did tell him.
Yeah. Yep. So after becoming a doctor and on vacation in Norway, Blake witnesses the arrival of an alien scouting party. Blake flees from the aliens into a cave. After discovering Thor's hammer, Mjolnir, disguised as a walking stick, and striking it against a rock, he transforms into the Thunder God. Later in Thor number 159, Blake is revealed to have always been Thor, Odin's enchantment having caused him to forget his memories as the Thunder God and believe himself mortal.
Well, that's convenient.
So they retcon that years later that, oh, you know, this was silly. Let's just
it's kind of weird, huh?
Yeah. So they kind of wanted to, I guess they were trying the Billy Batson
thing. I think it was a Captain Marvel type
thing. And it just didn't quite work out for them. And they were like, let's not do this anymore.
The only way it does work as far as if you want to bring a god who actually is like a real historical god to kind of put him in the real world, you know, so tie him to a human kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's pretty much all.
Going to humanize him.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I get that, but I think the whole fish out of water thing works so much better for Thor.
Oh, yeah.
Being a god amongst mortals and not quite understanding that world.
Right.
Makes me much more intrigued. That's why when I first heard about Thor, I had heard about that part.
Right.
And I was like, I don't like this. I don't like why he's in this dude. And
right.
He's got to use his thing and turn into, I was like, this is dumb. I'm out.
Because you never wanted to see that. You're going to be like, oh, I can't wait till he turns back into Donald Blake.
Yeah, nobody wanted to even read any of that. Yeah. They just wanted to see Thor kick ass.
Right.
And drink ale.
Right.
Yeah, that's
fight
it.
Giants and shit.
Right. So after Thor defeated the aliens, Thor shares a double life with his alter ego, treating the ill in a private practice with nurse and eventual lover, Jane Foster.
Mm-hmm.
And defending humanity from evil, Thor's presence on Earth almost immediately attracts the attention of his adopted brother and arch foe, Loki.
Mm-hmm.
So Loki comes in, the Avengers come in then. All this stuff starts to take place. We start getting appearances, first appearances of characters in Thor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of first appearances happen. A big one for you would be, I believe...
There's the Wrecker.
Right.
There's the Absorbing Man. I'm still trying to get that Absorbing Man one. That is a hard one to get. A lot of these early Thors are just finding them in good condition. I found the first Wrecker in great condition, and I just stared at it for a while because it's just Kirby art. One of my favorite, you know, I just love that kind of villain, like the Wrecking Crew and oh man, no, his, yeah. And the Absorbing Man, another issue, like of just a great character. They always had to make the characters on a god level. So they are always usually being in, it'd be like a criminal who got imbued, like the Wrecker. This crowbar got imbued with godlike power. So when he touches his crowbar, he's like an Asgardian god.
Yeah.
And same thing with Absorbing Man. I think Loki was just messing around and gave him these powers to absorb properties and make it like his body and stuff.
Nice.
Like
that. Yeah, to try it because he didn't want to do the dirty work himself.
No.
Yeah, makes sense.
The guy's so mischievous.
Yeah. So that's Thor in a nutshell, basically. Yeah. Thor also, the first appearance of one of my favorites, which was Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
And Hercules also was a DC Comics character too. But they didn't do him right.
No.
Marvel did him right. They made him the drunk, funny bastard that he is and that we all know and love. So I will forever be indebted to Thor and the comic Thor for creating one of my favorite characters, Hercules. Oh, sorry to interrupt everyone. Just wanted to mention real quick about a shop in Canoga Park, California called Spiro's Heroes. Elliot, the proprietor of the store, has over 300,000 books in what's called the Temple of Comics. That's Spiro Heroes in Canoga Park. SpiroHeroes.com. So with that, I guess we should move on to another one.
Yes, we're now going to hit the year 1963. And yes, the Avengers were created in 1963, as you spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my favorite teams of all time was created, and as well as Jared, the X-Men.
They didn't have much staying power, yeah.
Now, what's interesting, I discovered apparently that the X doesn't necessarily stand for like Professor Xavier's X-Men. It was just meant to stand for extra power.
Right.
Which is kind of cool, you know? Right. Makes sense for that time. And you have all these different parallels, what was going on in the real world in the 60s. And also, another thing that was interesting about the X-Men was that they were teenagers at mm-hmm. the time. So it's kind of like you're going through these adolescent changes and all of a sudden these powers happen to...
Because when your mutant power kicks in is usually around puberty.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's kind of cool how they made these metaphors about...
This came out of me, and then this also came out of me.
And also, Cyclops. Similar to Spider-Man and Peter Parker's issues, you know, they're alienated from the rest of the world. You know, they're... trying to do good, but you know, people are afraid of them, they're scared of them, they don't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to, unlike Peter, unfortunately, these guys, these five teenagers, had guidance in Professor X, they had a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been there, done that, he understands what they're going through, and he can mentor and teach them.
And had a full thinking process of what he wanted for the future of mutants.
He had a philosophy. As a matter of fact, his philosophy paralleled with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Kill them all.
No, that was more Magneto.
Sorry.
Yes, but you mentioned Magneto, their arch nemesis. His philosophy may have parallel with Malcolm X.
That's right.
Now, what's interesting about Magneto, that issue you mentioned, Hulk number 6?
Yeah.
The prototype for Magneto was in that issue called the Metal Master.
I'll be damned.
Right.
And very similar powers. The only difference was he was kind of an ugly guy with a bald head, but his costume scheme was kind of similar to Magneto's.
Right.
So I was showing you like a picture of that earlier.
Again, that's another issue that I would want to own just for that.
For that. Because like, of that little... who Magneto is, pretty much.
It's almost like a secret piece of history that not everybody knows about.
That's what's cool. When you did the Atlas, I told you about certain prototypes for other characters. Mm-hmm. And whatnot. But in this case, you know, when we're in the Silver Age, you have this prototype for Magneto 1 year before he actually was... created.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one thing that's great about the X-Men is that, like I said, it was at a time for social change. You have these five young people with
Who's the original team? Let's go over that.
Oh, yeah, I was about to start right now. You had Cyclops, you had Marvel Girl.
That's right.
Jean Grey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now everybody just calls her Jean Grey or Phoenix. Never Marvel Girl.
Yeah, Marvel Girl.
Yeah.
You had Iceman. And funny thing is when you look at that original depiction of Iceman, he looks more like a snowman.
He's like an icy. Yeah,
it's like he's throwing snowballs at you.
I want to say something real quick about Marvel Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Why haven't they reused that name?
Interesting, I don't know.
Like, because, think about it, with the Captain Marvel alone, it's mm-hmm. been handed down and switched off so many times. Marvel Girl's just sitting there, guys. Come on. Come on, Marvel, get with it.
Yeah.
Marvel Girl.
Like I said, they never, ever call her that again. I mean, she's never called that ever. Marvel Girl. She's Jean Grey.
Probably at least 30 years or something like that, if that.
Okay, so back to Snowball.
Yes. Yeah, Snowball, Iceman, Bobby Drake.
Mm-hmm.
Cyclops, someone that I'm not necessarily a big fan of, except in the Age of Apocalypse. I think he's cool there. Scott Summers. He's kind of like a bland, you know, by the books.
I liked him, but I liked his figure because I had the first original figure.
The one where you did the light up eyes?
Well, they both had the light up eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but the one he had the cap on, mm-hmm. like the skin cap over his head, that one was okay.
Right.
But I had already seen the cartoon.
Oh,
and
so
I was like, where's the hair?
You wanted the
where's the hair, Cyclops?
Wedge cut.
And then they came out with that figure and I was so stoked. I was like, there it is. Because let's be honest, we didn't have the greatest figures growing up.
Right.
They were way better than what our parents had because they were shit.
Yeah.
But the coolest thing things could do oftentimes is light up.
Mm-hmm.
And he had light up eyes.
Which is like his power is working. Kind of thing. Yeah,
totally. Exactly. It was basically showing you your imagination could be real.
Oh, almost. No, I remember like, losing on that toy, yeah.
Now, Cyclops, of course, had a very cool power, you know, that optic blast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just blast the virtual
imagine
anything.
That's
he
like
had a special visor to contain, you know.
Ruby quartz.
Right.
Ruby quartz.
Yeah, that's like tight pants on a guy that keeps popping a boner.
You know what? That could have been like, the parallel. You know, for his puberty.
Right. I just love figuring that out. God, we can't figure out any way to contain your eye beams. Here, let me just put this, I don't know, maybe I'll put a diamond in front of you. No, that doesn't work. I'll just put random stones in front of you. Hey, this ruby one works.
Amazing. Right.
We'll give you a ruby
quartz. Well, it was probably Hank McCoy that figured that one out because he's the genius of the group.
Yes, we cannot forget Beast Hank McCoy. Now, back then, he did not have the blue furry skin yet.
Nope.
He was big hands.
That did not come until Amazing Adventures number 11, I believe.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. I think that was what it was called, Amazing Adventures. Yeah. And he came with the blue fur.
But Hank McCoy, awesome character.
The Love best him. X-Men Love character.
Love him. He's one
hands
of the,
down.
He's one of the best. Definitely one of the best.
The best.
The best. Well, his evil version in the Age of Apocalypse, Dark Beast. Oh, man. He's awesome.
You know, I liked that character, but I hated the name. It was so Dark uninspired. Dark Beast. What is your name? It's like Cyborg Superman. It's like Dark Beast. Oh, okay. You know.
Dark Beast.
It couldn't have been like Mongrel or you know, something else related to a beast. But no, it's got to be Dark Beast. Wow.
Now, getting back to Marvel Girl real quick, of course, she had the power of telepathy and telekinesis, which is similar to her... You know, to Professor X, and so they can relate to each other. So you'd help her manage her abilities. And at one point, you know, Professor X was considered the most powerful telepath, and Jean Grey was considered the second most telepath. Mm-hmm. Of course, later on into the 70s when she got the Phoenix Force, but that'll be for another time. We'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, last but not least,
Warren Worthington III.
Warren Worthington III was the least, to me, the least.
Sorry.
The least likable character to me, you know, least interesting until the 1980s.
Yeah.
When he became Archangel and he was infected.
I've got daddy's money.
It's kind of a miracle he lasted that long.
Yes, that's true. You know what's funny? He's something that would have debuted like during Atlas or the late time comics.
Totally, just a guy with wings.
A guy with wings, the angel.
Yeah, well, they took the wings off Namor's ankles and put them on the back of, Warren. And
he's like, ow, oh, I get what you're doing.
Yeah. Now, these are tiny.
The original X-Men too. I remember digging their original costumes too. They like the black and the yellow, right?
Yeah, black, yellow, goldish color. Yeah. And of course in the X-Men First Class movie they kind of
they
alluded to that type of, you know,
right.
Classic uniform.
Yeah. Yeah, I still have a problem with that whole.
Now the X-Men too, didn't they much like they did something really weird. They kind of like Seinfeld. Seinfeld, remember, had like a first two seasons that didn't do really well. And then, like, I think the third season, they just kept like, trust me, it's going to get good. And then, like, it took off. Mm-hmm. The X-Men, I think the first, like, 30 issues or something like that didn't sell that great, I think.
Yeah, you know, the original...
it got canceled.
It got canceled probably and they about did five years or so. And then, yeah, they just started
doing reprints. Right. Because I remember buying an X-Men comic going... Oh, cool, it's an old X-Men comic. And they're like, well, actually, that's part of the reprint part.
Yep, I have one myself. I used to have one myself.
I got it off the wall. It's a reprint.
It's a reprint. Yeah, yeah. I had like one that was like Eric the Reds, but it was like a reprint or something like that.
Yeah, the Magneto
they're
one.
They're still worth something.
They're still worth it because they were from that time, but it was a reprint. Yeah,
right.
So, yeah, it only went like 67 to 8 issues or something like that, and then they just ended it because, yeah, it wasn't really selling that well. Mm-hmm. See, this is why when we get to the Bronze Age, how it just reinvented itself and really became what it became.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, even this original iteration, it's still a pretty good story. A pretty good group of people they put together, had all the social parallels going on.
Well, yeah, that was a big part of like mutants could be anything wasn't, you know, the norm.
The norm.
You know, an outsider. You had also some good first appearances in there. Magneto, we said. The Blob.
The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
Oh, the Blob was awesome. He was an unstoppable force.
Yeah.
You know?
Polaris, who would later become a lover of Havoc. Oh, Havoc himself. Havoc, can't forget Havoc.
Havoc. Juggernaut.
Juggernaut.
I'm the Juggernaut, bitch. Yeah.
Juggernaut, who, you know, was not a mutant, who was the stepbrother.
Who they always, people kept going, he's a mutant, he's a mutant. No. And he's like, no, he's not a mutant.
Don't let X-Men The Last Stand fool you.
Yeah. Now, any person that knows their weight in X-Men history knows Kane Marco, the Juggernaut, got his powers from the, what was it, the Ruby Sidorak?
Sidorak.
Yeah. When touched it. And he was the stepbrother
of Professor
Charles
X.
Xavier.
Picked on him when he was a kid.
That was an interesting aspect that they played with there, that whole twist kind of. It was kind of a twist.
Oh, totally.
You know?
Yeah, and also especially like, he was the bully who just got immensely stronger. It's like, yeah. Doesn't have like a good karma issue there. Yeah. You're just like,
and it was cool. Like he had to have that helmet on or protect themselves from Xavier's.
That was always the thing. If you were fighting the Juggernaut, how do we get that
helmet
fucking
off.
Helmet
that
off?
Helmet off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except that's why there's that great story jumping ahead, obviously, but that one where Spider-Man fights him for 2 issues and he's just like, I can't figure out how to beat him. And I think he eventually just gets him stuck in cement and like runs away.
It's yeah. Like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
How do you stop an unstoppable force? You know, that was the problem he had.
Also, you can't forget Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch made their debuts
that's
as well.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Children of Magneto, which we would find
much
later on.
Much later on. Better in the Fox world than the Marvel world.
Yes.
Yes.
As far as Quicksilver is concerned, anyway.
Yes. Yeah, unforgettable.
But this, of course, leads us to 1964, to the creation of a particular superhero with
a disability.
A disability. But made up for it.
That's right. We're talking about Matthew Murdock, a.k.a. Daredevil.
Oh, yeah. I heard about this guy.
This guy.
Yeah.
This guy was something. No, Daredevil, he was created, like we were saying, 64. He actually was one of those ones who actually just started out with this book, Daredevil 1. That was his first appearance. April 1964, created by writer and editor Stan Lee and artist, this is what's cool, Bill Everett. Bill Everett, I told you in the very first one, was the creator of Submariner, and I said he would come back later on, and he did.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah, so that guy is a straight-up OG from the Golden Age coming back to the Silver Age and creating one of our timeless Marvel characters, Daredevil.
Yeah, he's got a Netflix show, I heard.
Oh, and it's probably the best
one out of
all.
By the way, you have to remember, there was an assist in the creation of that
There was
costume.
A character design input, of course, by Jack Kirby. Who
that guy just tries to take credit for everything.
I know. I did that and I did this.
Stan Lee was crying.
And Stan was crying the whole fucking time. Now, Daredevil, Jack Kirby also is supposedly the design, but also he is the one who devised the Billy Club. The famous Billy Club that Daredevil
uses.
Oh,
yeah.
Once again, Matt Murdock, he was a kid. Moved the old guy out of the way. And of course, there were some chemicals involved and radiation, isotope, and it blinded him. But it awakened his other senses to superhuman levels.
So he got superhuman strength.
Yeah. No.
Super,
no.
Superhuman
no.
speed.
I just want to know how many kids were like.
He could fly.
Nope. Yeah. He can taste things better. He can hear the shit out of things.
Great.
He could.
That's great.
He pretty much had to like sonar. So it's pretty much like he could see, which was always weird.
Had his version of Spidey sense.
They did that really well, I thought, in the Affleck Daredevil movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they showed his how he could see with the sonar kind of thing.
Okay.
It was pretty cool.
I refused to see that movie.
That was about the only thing that was
cool.
Because
they put Bullseye with a fucking target.
And they had a playground fight scene between him and Elektra. I shit you not. Yeah.
Hey, but that worked out for them. They Oh, no, they're divorced.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So Daredevil, he gets heightened senses and he eventually gets fighting skills, but we kind of find that more later on as far as how he became such a good fighter, as far as stick and all that. But that's Bronze Age stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Writer and comics historian Mark Evanier, I don't know, has suggested without confirmation that Kirby also designed the basic image of Daredevil's initial costume, though Everett modified it. Now, if you don't know, the original costume was yellow. And maroon or like
something like that.
Yeah, and the first one actually just had a D, and then I think it was Wally Wood. Wally Wood did the Kirby. I think redesigned it with the DD. They with still the yellow, and then Wally Wood introduced Daredevil's modern red costume in issue number 7, in which Daredevil's battle against the far physically superior Submariner has become one of the most iconic stories of the series. Once again, another historical issue that you'd want because. It's the first red costume. It's pretty much what all Daredevil fans know.
Yeah.
The series 31-issue run by writer-editor Stan Lee and penciler Gene Colan includes Daredevil 47, in which Murdock defends a blind Vietnam veteran against a frame-up. Lee has cited it as one of his favorite stories in the series.
Aw, ain't that sweet.
Now, he was the son of battling Jack Murdock, who was a boxer. He lived in the streets of Hell's Kitchen, but he grows up to become an attorney at law, Matthew Murdock.
Helping the downtrodden.
Yeah. Now, what was cool about Matt Murdock is he seamlessly blended into the other comic books because they would find themselves in trouble.
Right.
And they would need an attorney. And then someone would be like, well, I know this one attorney.
Yeah.
And Matt Murdock would come in and then, you know, they'd have their, you know, they're getting framed by, you know, the owl, and then they got to fight the owl, and then Daredevil shows up. But how did he know about this? Because he's fucking Matt Murdock.
Yeah.
And I will say his rogues gallery is pretty damn awesome, too.
He's got, really? Hit me.
I mean, the owl, you know, Wolverine with not real claws, and he was old. Stiltman, the guy who could, you know, go up really high to buildings and get things.
Uh-huh.
We did have Gladiator. Gladiator, they made into quite a cool character. But no, his rogues gallery does not take off until the Bronze Age. In fact, his whole development doesn't really take off until the Bronze Age.
Very sordid X-Men. You didn't get that real great development until
when
the 70s.
New kid on the block, Frank Miller, did some shit. But we'll get into that.
Yep.
But no, he had a long run. The only thing of note that happened in the Silver Age, I would say, is, you know, they, like I said, introduced some cool villains. But also, he met his first love interest, Karen Page.
You sold him down the river.
Oh my God. She is going to be a shitstorm of shitstorms. Daredevil 2, I will say this, has the worst history with women. All the women in his life, he either ruins their life or they ruin his life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the worst. I mean, he's a total Mac Daddy. He's like, you know, he gets all the women, but like, they're either assassins, schizophrenics, they get driven mad by villains, they commit suicide. One committed suicide.
Jesus.
One becomes a porn, Karen Page becomes a porn, porn star, drug addict, and sells them out. But that's a story for another time. But they do meet and have a happy, happy existence in the 60s. Little on-again, off-again relationship.
That's
but like
great.
I said, the real character, this was all the groundwork. The real character's development, like so many others, is in the Bronze Age. And now I'm going to have to say that's going to be it for our Silver Age. When we got some...
Yeah, one last thing. I just want to point out that towards the end of the Silver Age, the sales doubled. In 1960, 16.1 million copies were sold of Marvel Comics. By 1965, 32 million.
Wow. 32 well, I mean, million books.
Look at all this stuff we're saying. Is like, they created this guy. Then the next year, this guy came out. This one.
They want to be on the what's the next great thing.
Yeah. Because the college kids were a huge factor in their exploring popularity because they created these characters that related to. They had real problems. Some of them were teenagers, some were in their early 20s. So, you know, it's like, oh, man, I can relate to this guy. And then Doctor Strange, we didn't mention, was super popular among the college crowd.
And that could also be why a lot of the Marvel Silver Age, not only because of the age of the books, but the reason why they're more obtainable could also be because they were in the hands of more seasoned readers, more adult-esque readers.
Or people that didn't also, like, said, this is a great story. I don't want to just throw this away. It's like a good book. You know, I'm going to keep it. Hold on to
people
it.
People that could maybe appreciate it a little more.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's always the case, but that could obviously play into that.
And this era, one last thing, also represented the end of independence for these, for Marvel, as well as DC later on. A company called Perfect Film and Chemical Corporation in 1968, Martin Goodman sold Marvel Comics to, so he cashed out.
Ah, yeah. He's smart.
Sounds like such an evil like company, to like a front for something.
It does.
Yes,
it
we're
does.
A perfect chemical and film
where
company.
Where the Joker was created.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of reminds me of G.I. Joe. Remember like Tomax and Zaymot? They had like that front company for Cobra, Extensive Enterprises.
Extensive Enterprises. Yeah, it's got to be some just generic name.
Generic name.
Yep.
Well, that'll do it for part two of the Silver Age and part 3B of the Marvel Comics history.
Yep.
We will be returning, I believe, with the Bronze Age.
Yes, we will.
And goddamn, is shit going to go off the hook, because there's a lot more stuff in that, too.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to explode in my pants.
We're sorry if we didn't get to your favorite character, but the Silver Age, it's just, once you're hitting this level, it's nuts.
Yep.
And
show us the love. Subscribe to us on YouTube. We're also on iTunes.
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Sundays, we do a Sunday SmackDown. We kind of pit two characters together. Chime in. Tell us who you think would win. YouTube, like I said, I always tell people go like, I don't know how to work the iPod thing on the phone with the podcast. And I go, then just go to YouTube and you can listen to it there.
We got videos now. We've got some fun. We got a video of us going to the comics convention. One of them. We're going to have more soon.
Danny Rand.
A skit with Danny Rand. Yeah.
The Iron Fist Netflix show. We actually have some unseen footage that they kind of lent us, and it's really powerful stuff.
Yeah, better than the show. They should have put it in there.
Yeah. But we'll either see you there, or we'll see you at the comic shop.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.